Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome. I just spoke with Michael Gibbs Hill about his new book, Linchu Inc., that's for Incorporated, Translation and the Making of Modern Chinese Culture. And that came out with Oxford University Press in 2013, although some of us may have had a copy as early as 2012. Now, this is a book that follows the life and the work and the career of an individual, Lin Chu, who's a relatively well-known figure in the history of literature and translation. But what Hill's book does is really transforms the way we think about Lin Chu as an individual and instead replaces our image of translation and scholarship as done by a single author, a single individual, with a picture of Lin Chu as a member of a scholarly network of collaborators. This is somebody who was famous for translation, who produced, I think, over 180 translations of Western literary works into classical Chinese while knowing zero foreign languages. He worked with a lot of assistants and collaborators who did, but still, it's a pretty impressive feat. And it's kind of interestingly strange. And what Hill's book does is really make the history of translation in China also interestingly strange. He changes the way we think about what it means to read a translation and to read with a translation and to think with a translation. It's exceptionally interesting. It's a book that really organically straddles both the field of modern history and the field of literary studies and comparative literature as well. It's of interest to scholars of political history, of print culture, of translation history, and also of the history of modern China. This is really a book not just about translation, but about the emergence of and the formation of a modern intellectual in China through some of these practices. It's full of really, really interesting close readings of some of Lin Chu and his collaborators' translations, and it was a lot of fun to talk with him about it. So I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Michael Gibbs Hill about his new book, Linchu Inc., Translation and the Making of Modern Chinese Culture. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Michael, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Hi, Carla. Thanks for having me on.
So, Michael, could you start us off by saying a little bit about what brought you to this field? How did you wind up as a scholar of modern Chinese literature?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, at one point, I think I'd actually forgotten how all of this happened. But when I was in high school, I took German and took quite a bit of German language and kind of started that in college. And in the time between high school and college, I made a visit to Germany, and this would have been not long after the Berlin Wall fell. And we made a visit to East Germany. I remember we went to the former Karl Marx Stadt, which is now known as Chemnitz. And it was at that time I really became interested in what at that time we were calling sort of so-called post-socialist societies. And when I was in college, I decided I wanted to try to take a language that would be related to one of those parts of the world. And so it boiled down to a choice between Chinese and Russian. And I almost took Russian, but it was sort of on a lark that I decided to try Chinese. And it just so happened that I had a wonderful first teacher. And then once I started, I just was ended up kind of shifting my entire area of interest and emphasis toward working on Chinese language and literature.
So the book that we're talking about today, and it's a book with a gorgeous cover, I'll mention for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to see it. The book looks at the way a man called Lin Chu became a central force in the literary culture of the late Qing and the early Republican periods. And so we're talking about roughly the period 1895 to roughly 1927, the late 1920s. And that you also look at the relevance of changing modes of and attitudes toward translation in this context, among many other things. So how did you come to focus on Lin Chu in particular? Why him and why this figure?
I think I really developed an interest in Lin Chu when I started graduate school. I started in the PhD program in comparative literature at Rutgers. And it's a very interdisciplinary program, and you take courses in all kinds of different departments. And oddly enough, I think my interest in Lin Chu actually came from taking courses in Rutgers' English department that were related to the Victorian period. partly many of the novels that Lin Shu and his collaborators translated come from that period, you know, kind of famous novelists like Dickens and H. Rider Haggard and folks like that. And also, I think at that time, I sort of saw how fun and interesting scholarship on the Victorian period was. I mean, the Victorian period is sort of, lots of it is really gloriously trashy, especially many of the kinds of popular novels. And I found, as I looked at the late Qing, the sort of late 19th, early 20th century, this period from, you know, the 1880s through the 1910s, you have a lot of kind of similar phenomenon and lots of similar kinds of texts, really. The Late Qing period, I think, was for a long time kind of derided for being a period that didn't have very high quality literary writing. There are lots of unfinished novels, things that were published in journals that you'll see, you know, you maybe read seven or eight chapters and you know, it becomes very clear, you know, after a certain amount of time that the author just got bored and stopped writing the rest of the novel. So then it just sort of trails off. You also have a number of texts that are very kind of spurious. You have no idea who they can be attributed to, or they're written anonymously. Or in the case of translation, you even have instances where someone might say translate a text from Japanese or English into Chinese and then pass it off as their own work, or vice versa. Someone might write an original work and then try to say that it's a translation itself. So it was this kind of messy period that I found was quite interesting to me. And I'd always really been interested in translation itself. So learning about a figure like Lin Shu, who is famously this translator who knew no foreign languages, and yet without the benefit of knowing any foreign languages, managed to translate almost 200 novels. This just seemed to be a topic that was too good to pass up. And there had been a few pieces that had been written about him in English, but it was one of these figures that everyone sort of knew about, but had not really received a kind of in-depth discussion pretty much, I think, in any Western language. And it was sort of once I started working on that thread, then I knew I wanted to structure my dissertation project around Lin Shu and his collaborators.
Great. And we'll talk much more about him and his background and sort of what exactly it meant and it looked like for him to translate in the context of not knowing any foreign languages in a moment. But you just mentioned that this actually began as dissertation work. So can you talk for us a little bit about how you went from the dissertation to the book? What was that transition like? Were there any major issues, major transformations, any surprises along the way? Anything about that process?
I think a couple of things happened. First of all, what happened is as I started working on this project, it was kind of interrupted. I decided for a while that I needed to take a break from graduate school. And so I finished the master's at Rutgers and actually ended up working at a large translation firm in New York City. It was a very, very odd transition or unexpected transition for myself, but I found myself working on a building in Park Avenue in the Murray Hill district of Manhattan, working as the sort of China hand for this very large translation company. And it was my job to oversee all of the translation, or at least the work of freelancers that was going into and out of Chinese. And it was all kinds of topics, whether it was things related to legal documents or financial documents or patents or things like that. And that actually really kind of gave me a completely different view of the process of translation itself. Began to see it as a very different kind of professional and social practice. And so having that little sort of break and then going on to finish at Columbia, I think sort of changed my entire view of how I wanted to approach the topic in the first place. Once I'd finished, I think probably the best piece of advice I got as I was working on turning the dissertation into a book was to just set it aside for a little while and to take some time to think and maybe think about some other things that were important issues for me in the late 19th and early 20th century. So I started working on a couple of small side projects. When I was doing the tail end of my dissertation research, I became interested in some of these kinds of forged translations that were published in the late 19th and early 20th century. And I just sort of kept a file on them, thinking that I wanted to work on them at some point. And after I arrived here in South Carolina, I took some of those out and started working on them again. And it was a project that was in the same period that I was interested in and covered similar issues, but it sort of got my head out of the dissertation. I think it's very difficult for many people when they, you know, often they'll rush to finish up. And certainly I was not very happy with the final product. And then, you know, as soon as you move and you're sitting among moving boxes and want to return to the original project that you've been working on, it's a little bit difficult. So having some time to work on something else, I think, would prove to be really helpful. Once I did return to the project, I ended up spending some time thinking about how I wanted to relate, or let me put it a different way, what kind of audience I wanted to speak to, right? Because in many of my conferences and other kinds of things, as I was working on the project, I actually ended up hanging out with lots of historians rather than people in Chinese literature because of the emphasis of the book on print culture. So I had to think a little bit about who was the audience. So folks in Chinese literature and history. I also wanted to write it in a way that would be accessible to scholars who worked on English literature or American literature or comparative literature. So there's certain kinds of things that I think have to be done in the process of writing, where you step back and say, okay, how do I explain this particular text to someone who is not a scholar of Chinese literature? At the same time, you also have to do things for people who you think are your primary audience. So when I'm discussing, for example, Washington Irving, I felt like I had to step back and explain to readers, maybe do some very kind of basic explanation to readers who might not be familiar with these texts. So there's trying to read and reread and rewrite sections of the book from multiple perspectives. So, and then also, of course, to make it to accessible to other audiences, say folks who work in translation studies and so forth. And then beyond that, I think it's just, particularly when you work on a single figure or a single figure in his circle, right? So Lin Zhu and his collaborators, you always have to spend a lot of time thinking about how you balance out the narrative of an individual or an individual and his cohort or his cronies, and the kinds of thematic issues that you want to treat. So that also requires a lot of thinking and balancing back and forth between those issues. And I have to say, I felt like I threw out quite a bit of the initial part of the dissertation, or at least the first half of it, as I was going through that. But it was overall, it wasn't too painful, but it definitely requires sort of, I think, stepping back and looking and rereading the work in progress from a number of different perspectives.
I think that's actually really good advice for anybody going from the dissertation to thinking about a book manuscript, right? Because you come out of the process, often many of us are just completely burnt out. You know, it's hard to have the kind of energy that it takes to read it with fresh eyes. And so I think that really paid off in this case, because reading the book for the first time, this is particularly, I'm mentioning this for listeners who haven't seen the book yet. It came out very recently. In fact, my copy, even though I got it in 2012, says 2013 on it. So it was very, you know, looking into the future, wacky when I looked at that. But for listeners who may not yet have read it, it very much transcends either the field of modern Chinese literature or modern Chinese history. And it's completely transdisciplinary, at least from the perspective of a reader from history in that respect. So well done.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I think it would also fit really well in syllabi for courses in both of those fields.
The other part of this too, I think that was at least a kind of practical thing that I also received some advice on, was just as you move into sort of working on the first book, is to really talk to people outside of your initial circle of the dissertation committee when you're thinking about publishers and things like that. Because I think East Asian Studies, we have a relatively small number of real core publishers. And yet it could be very helpful to talk to folks who have recently published books out there to see what might be kind of new possible outlets for your work. That's also how it ended up in this particular series.
And one of the great things also about the book, and then I'll move us to legitimate content, is that there are Chinese characters in the book. All of the long quotations, or most of them have, as I recall, have Chinese characters right in the text. And so that's really, really helpful. And not all presses do that.
Yes, that was very gracious of Oxford to be willing to do that. It meant some extra work in the proof process, but I really appreciate them doing that.
So you've already talked a little bit about Lin Shu This is somebody who's the focal figure in this study, but very explicitly, it's not called Lin Shu Translation and the Making of Modern Chinese Culture. It's called Lin Shu Inc., or Incorporated Translation and the Making of Modern Chinese Culture. You're very careful in the book, and this starts from the very beginning, to mention that the kind of translation that Lin Shu did, especially given the fact that, as you've mentioned, he didn't know any foreign languages, he did by working with, I think you mentioned, 20 assistants who were trained in various languages and developed what had been referred to as a factory of writing. So you treat him in the book not as an individual only, but really as a key member of a larger network of individuals. So I'd love to, if you could start off by talking a little bit about that approach. How did you decide to focus on that, and what particular kinds of challenges did that pose as you were deciding to, you know, how to treat Lin Shu as a figure in the course of the book?
I think as I started working on the project, one of the first things that I realized was that particularly in, well, both in English language and Western language and in Chinese language, discussions of Lin Shu, it came down to a real question of materials and how we approach the materials. In many cases, we find that someone like Lin Shu, usually if he's treated as a literary figure, as a translator, as a kind of thinker, it's the materials that are used by scholars often are extremely limited, and they usually boil down to the prefaces that he wrote to his translations, and maybe some other short kinds of critical essays that he may have written in to address a number of different literary questions. But the vast body of his work was the translations themselves, and in many cases, they're simply just not really treated in a direct way. So the first question that I had is that, okay, so if we want to read the translations, how then do we deal with this problem of agency? And this is always a question in translation itself, right? Because translation is a kind of derivative form of writing. You have both the writings of the author himself or herself, and then the translator and what kind of interpolations that they might make. And in the case of Lin Shu and his collaborators, you have at least two different translators, right? So you have this kind of a process of what's called relay translation, where we have the original text, and then it's being moved through one of his collaborators, and then to Lin Shu himself, and then into the translated text that he produced. So really, I think one of the first questions that you have to deal with is how do you read these translations? How do you explain, say, for example, differences between the source and the translation? How do you even want to address those kinds of questions? So it was in sort of approaching these materials that I began thinking about Lin Shu as a member of this kind of larger network. And also just simply from the facts of his biography as well. He was just sort of a very unlikely literary figure, someone who had been, yes, he had passed some of the examinations, he passed the provincial level examinations, but after that really had just been kind of a itinerant school teacher, and it wasn't until he was in his late 30s, early 40s that he suddenly became this kind of overnight success. And that kind of phenomenon is something that can only be the result of a larger set of processes. So as I approached Lin Shu as a figure, those were some of the issues that were in the back of my mind.
So for people who are interested in translation studies, and we'll also come to this a little bit later, and really, I think, throughout the conversation, because it's an issue throughout the book, but you just mentioned something that comes up as a recurring theme throughout the book, which is the importance of moving beyond paratexts in looking at translation. And this is something that comes up in the context of a discussion of what you call thinking beyond thought, thinking beyond sort of the problem of, or thinking through the problem of original thought, or sisya, as we are trying to understand how to use translations as texts from the perspective of a historian or a literary scholar. Did you want to say anything more to that effect? Because that seems to be a really major call that you're making in the book to all of us who are thinking about and thinking with translation, to not only read kind of more of a text, but to really read differently when we're taking into account translation in the context of the history of China and the history of literature in particular.
Well, I think, thanks very much. That's a very good probably better than what I could do, I think, in terms of summarizing some of the initial arguments that I make in the introduction. I think that whether we're talking about literary writing or quite a bit of the intellectual history of the late 19th and early 20th century, we do have to face this problem of translation and how we want to read those texts. And so one of the things that I point out in the introduction in particular, and that sort of keeps coming, I try to bring this up again and again in the chapters, is that we do have this kind of tendency in intellectual history and in literary history as well to really focus on those texts to which we can attribute a kind of original voice of an author. So one example that I use is another very famous translator, Yan Fu, who did know English and knew it quite well, and also translated into classical Chinese. And there are many cases where we see sort of intellectual histories that address his work their way around the translations themselves. Yan Fu inserted many, many kinds of commentaries and prefaces and things like this. And so we find ourselves sort of reading those particular paratexts without actually getting into the body of the translations themselves. And one of the points I try to make, particularly with dealing with Lin Shu, is that since methods of translations were so disputed at that time, since there was not necessarily a single standard for translation or a single kind of norm that could be used as a yardstick against which to measure any number of more, not just Lin Shu's translations, but the work of other writers, that the problem of authority in translation, of the qualifications of the translator, those kinds of issues are themselves themes that appear in the text of the translations. So it's, and this is a way that the translations kind of express an agency that can give us a very different perspective on the literary and cultural history of the period.
And speaking of the literary, or giving us a new perspective on the literary and cultural history of the period, one of the things that you're arguing in the book, and I think it's useful to get this out right now because it also comes up in different ways a little bit later, you're arguing that the work of Lin Shu Inc., right? Lin Shu and his collaborators and his colleagues, it actually helps us understand the transformation of what you call mental labor and intellectual work in modern China. So there are pretty vast consequences for the study of what would seem to be, you know, an individual figure, even though we've already talked about the fact that he's an individual that's actually a multiplicity, right? But this idea of mental labor and the use of this figure of Lin Shu and his collaborators to understand the transformation of this concept is what I'd like to ask you about. So can you talk a little bit about this and the centrality of it or the role it played in your conceptualizing this work?
Sure. I think it's well known that the work of translation itself becomes important to what constitutes an intellectual in the late 19th and early 20th century China. So in my discussion of mental labor, I try to find a way to kind of take that apart a little bit more clearly. If the intellectual itself is not a natural category, it's not a kind of stable category we can refer to, then what I argue is that we need to look at the kind of what is the constellation of activities that make up the work of the intellectual. And what we see in the late 19th, early 20th century is a growing importance of knowledge of foreign languages. And of course, translation itself also become a very important part of the work of the intellectual, sometimes in very practical ways. Some scholars have shown, for example, that translations for publications, the work of translation there, actually played a very important role in the way that the entire royalty system for publications grew in the late 19th and early 20th century. Of course, it also becomes a very important mode of claiming authority. The ability of writers to bring new texts into the Chinese language provides not only, in some cases, a way for them to break into print for the first time. We look at figures like Zhou Zuoren, the brother of Lu Xun. Many of his early publications were all translations. It provides a kind of avenue for younger intellectuals to gain entry into intellectual discourse. It also also for more important figures, it also becomes a way of claiming authority. And so this is the kind of thread that I trace through through his career, and then later also through Lin Xu's conflicts with figures who we now know as being members of the New Culture and May 4th Movement.
Now, after the introduction, where you're setting up a lot of these sort of central problems and major concepts that we're going to see later on in the book, after this, you take us through a series of chapters where we see Lin Xu transforming. He transforms from a kind of activist and patriotic translator to what you describe as an arbiter between a classical Chinese language and literature and a national language, and we'll talk about that. He eventually becomes a kind of media star who stands for traditionalist cultural values, but brings them to leisure readers. And then ultimately, at the end of the book, we see him in his downfall, pretty much, as a symbol of the most reactionary strains of the Chinese cultural tradition. So let's get into how this happens and see at least part of this transformation as it's taking place. So as you get us started after the introduction, Chapter 2 gives us a framework to help understand Lin Xu's career with respect to two kinds of tools that you call broken tools. The nature of what makes them broken is actually kind of interesting, but two tools that are going to play really important roles in the backbone, or they form the backbone of his career through all of their stages in different ways. The first of these tools is his method of translation. He used a mode that you translate here as tandem translation. Is this what you meant? Is this equivalent to relay translation, or is this something different?
I think the terms tandem translation, I think, or Dui Yi, usually refers to two people sitting in the same room with one another. And I believe relay translation can actually be people working on different texts, but not necessarily in the same room. But Dui Yi is, or tandem translation is, this process where at least two people are sitting together. One person who has a knowledge of the foreign language, who kind of does a oral rendition of the text, sentence by sentence, and then another person, who in this case was Lin Xu, writes it down, at least a draft, and then usually a final version of the text in written Chinese. And it's very common practice at that time, because we find, whether it's missionary organizations or many of these kinds of scientific institutions like the School of the Jiangnan Arsenal and similar kinds of institutions, you see that very few people actually had a strong enough command of both Chinese and a foreign language to render a text, or to render a translation all by themselves. It usually required at least one other collaborator, if not more.
One of the really interesting things that's happening in this chapter and in this section of the book is you're showing that this mode of producing text, so tandem translation or Dui Yi, is actually related to and is shaped by other modes of textuality that are happening sort of in the intellectual environment and in the background of the translators. And these include fiction commentary and sequel writing. And these this actually becomes really important later. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking about that relationship between these, different modes of textuality for us.
Sure. When you have this kind of divide between the person who possesses the kind of technical knowledge of the foreign language and then the person who is writing down the text, what I argue is that there's a certain kind of ethics or way of approaching the text that comes from late imperial Chinese fiction in particular that ends up being very important for Lin Xu. Now, for folks who are familiar with works like, The Water Margin, Shui Hu Zhuan, and Hong Lulong, the Story of the Stone, and texts like that, I mean, most of these come with very extensive kinds of commentaries. There are many... There are also a number of sequels that are written to these texts, where we see in traditional Chinese fiction that there's almost a... an interest both in improving on the original, in some cases, or on elaborating on themes that existed in the original work of fiction, and also in guiding readers and in showing them how to read a text properly. And one of the things I think we see particularly in translations of works by Dickens is we see kind of some of the devices of late imperial Chinese fiction, the use of commentators and multiple narrators coming in to sort of show readers how they could read properly, and in fact, how they can become a kind of modern reader. So that's one of the backgrounds that comes into the way these texts are produced.
Yeah, that's actually a fascinating part of the book for listeners. This focus on Dickens' work and the translations that Lin Shu and his collaborators did of Dickens happens in Chapter 4. And there's this really wonderful description of their decisions to really produce a kind of reader that could engage with the kinds of, and we'll get to this, but the kinds of issues of social reform through reading that they wanted by manipulating for example, transforming what had been one translator into two different kinds of, or rather one narrator into two different kinds of narrators in the same text in the translation. So this, I mentioned this just to make clear that when we're talking about translation here, it's actually really exciting in a way, right? Because we're not, you know, when most people think translation, most people are probably thinking of a, you know, relatively straightforward rendering of one to another. It conjures images of fidelity and, sameness and authenticity and yada, yada, yada. But what you're showing here is it really is a creative mode that offered lots of different possibilities and options for being a creative author as a translator than most people might be aware of when they're thinking about the context of the history of translation.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And especially in this period, I think that the kind of the most shocking discovery we might make would be to see, in some cases, to actually see a very straightforward translation that is, in fact, you know, very, very, very true to the original. I think that that's probably the exception to the rule in many cases. And that's sort of why, again, also, I think it's important to kind of think about the role of close reading, which we think of as being a kind of central method of literary history, but how we employ that particular kind of analysis when we look at translations. But we can talk a little bit more about that as we get into some of the later chapters.
Absolutely. And we're about to get there. But I wanted to just mention before we get there that the other tool that you mentioned in this chapter, along with tandem translation, that becomes really important for defining Lin Shu and his career and his approach later on, is his use of the classical language to translate 18th and 19th century European vernacular fiction. And this becomes an issue later on. You mentioned that this, like, his use of ancient style prose actually lets him and his translation collaborators bring kinds of texts, marginal texts, objectionable texts, into the orbit of classical study in a way that wasn't possible before. And this has really interesting ramifications for him. So could you talk about that for a little bit?
Sure. This is the other half of the chapter. Usually when kind of thinking about the history of Lin Shu and his collaborators, the two questions people ask, well, first of all, how can he translate without knowing any foreign languages? And why on earth would someone want to translate it into classical Chinese? And so a lot of what this chapter tries to do is to kind of explain not only why these make sense, but what their significance is. And certainly classical Chinese, I mean, given the kind of narratives of the history of 20th century Chinese culture that have been so strong really since the 1920s, classical Chinese is often seen as this kind of, how do I want to say this? It is a mode of communication that just simply has to be taken apart for any number of reasons. Classical Chinese is usually blamed for low rates of literacy, the inability to translate technical knowledge into Chinese. Really, it's many, many different kinds of problems are laid at its door, whether it's I'm trying to think. Well, they're so numerous, it's difficult to lay them all out at once. And certainly, it's a very important part of the New Culture and May 4th movement is to set itself in opposition to classical Chinese. And so, what I try to argue in this part of the chapter is just to show why there are certain possibilities for Lin Shu and his collaborators that not only made sense, but then also made it possible for them to become innovators in this period.
So as we move from this to the set of really interesting close readings that make up the middle of the book, you also, and I'll just mention this for listeners, you're not just describing these tools, but you also later on in this chapter contextualize Lin Shu and his collaborators' use of these tools in the context of imperial and colonial history. And so there is material here of interest to historians of imperial and colonial global, the imperial and colonial global world, or whatever you want to call it, that might not be obvious from the outset or from the title. And so imperial and colonial historians and literary scholars take note of Chapter 2 especially, and also Chapter 3. So as we move into these next chapters, we start moving into focus studies of particular translations that Lin Xu and his collaborators did that both reflect that are cases in point for illustrating some of his major approaches, but that also take us through the really interesting stages of his rise and fall, so to speak, as an intellectual in this period. So the third chapter looks closely at close readings of two translations Lin Xu was involved in that both helped him and his collaborators, as you show here, establish lasting relevance for their work. And the title of the chapter, "The Name Is Changed, But the Tale Is Told of You," is taken from a quotation by Marx and illustrates the centrality of labor, as we sort of mentioned earlier, that will continue to be really important to this story. So the first translation that you focus on here is a rendering of Uncle Tom's Cabin by Lin Xu and his collaborators, Lin Xu and Wei Yi in particular. Now, for listeners, what's really interesting here is that each one of these translations also comes with a new kind of title. So as we talk about these for the rest of our conversation, I'll mention them initially as the kind of the source text, if you will, and I know how problematic that concept is, but source text that Lin Xu and his collaborators were working from, but then we'll move to the title that Lin and company actually gave the text. And here, Uncle Tom's Cabin became a record of the black slave's plea to heaven.
Right.
Okay, so this is fascinating. And in this text, they're engaging with a global literature on African slavery and sort of relating it to the issue of Chinese coolies and Chinese laborers. So can you, for listeners, talk about the nature of Lin and Company's version of the text and how maybe some important ways that it actually differed from Harriet Beecher Stowe's version of the text?
Sure. I think the first thing is that Uncle Tom's Cabin was one of the most widely translated novels of the 19th and 20th centuries. We've seen many different versions of it in, for example, in Spanish. I believe that there's a book that's actually coming out just on Uncle Tom's Cabin and Russian culture in the 19th and 20th centuries. So this is a very compelling work that has found audiences in places around the world in a number of different languages. It's really, I think, if we look at the work of Franco Varela, and the way that he traces the movement of different novels around the world in the 19th and particularly in the 19th century, this has to be one of those most important works. So when Lin Xu was working on this text, the first question is, of course, how did it come to him? And the guess that I make in the book is that it was probably used as a textbook at St. John's College, which is where Wei Yi attended and probably took a degree there. Given that the fact that the school was run by missionaries, it's probably likely that if it wasn't used in the classroom, then he was introduced to it there. And one of the things I think that's interesting, well, two things I'll talk about. First of all, in Uncle Tom's Cabin, I think one of the most important parts of the Black Slave's Plea to Heaven, which is the translation prepared by Lin Xu and Wei Yi, is that the character George Harris really becomes the hero. And George is a character who is an escaped slave, and he first flees to the north, and then to Canada, and then to France, and then again. And a lot of this we learned in the novel through him sort of sending letters back and forth to his family and so forth. And then eventually he agrees to go with his family to Liberia to start, basically to return to Liberia. And what we see in this case is it's a really interesting example of the way that a certain problem in the novel, as it was originally written, becomes transformed and takes on an entirely different meaning in a new context. Harriet Beecher Stowe was very severely criticized by critics at the time for sending George back to Liberia, because it was believed by some critics at the time that she was sponsoring or giving some sort of credibility to an organization called the American Colonization Society, which was calling for a return of all slaves of African descent to the African continent, right? So it was an organization that was calling for the end of slavery, but was also basically arguing against any kind of diverse culture, North American culture after the Civil War. But what we see in this case is that George becomes this, in The Black Slave Fleet to Heaven and Lin Shu and Wei Yi's version of the novel, he becomes a very heroic character. And at the end of the novel, he speaks in this language that diverts quite a bit from Harry Beecher Stowe's novel, and in fact uses the vocabulary of what at that time was known as so-called Western learning, or Xi Xue, which partly relates to both scientific and technical knowledge translated from Western languages and from Japanese, and also kind of larger, more general social sciences, law, things like that. So there's this kind of long speech where George talks about founding a new nation according to these principles, many of which seem to have some kind of relation to Western learning. And so we see both two things happen here. First of all, we see the way this kind of problem that relates to the American colonization society is transformed and becomes a completely different and new thing in the novel as translated by Lin Shu and Wei Yi. We also see this kind of new ideal intellectual emerge in the novel, where George, as translated by Lin Shu and Wei Yi, speaks the language of the new intellectual. And so it's right at this conclusion, we see that George is not only the real hero, but he's come to represent who the translators see as a kind of idealized version of the new intellectual. So that's one way that we try to engage in close reading of these texts.
And you make the point here also that George kind of typifies something really important that's happening in this translation, which is that Lin and his colleagues are establishing ancient-style prose as a basis for a national language of critique. And this is a really important move, right?
Right. And the kind of opening quote that I use for the chapter is something from Hu Shi, who was actually one of Lin Shu's great adversaries later in the teens and 20s, who made this kind of offhand comment that said, Lin Shu opened a new colony for ancient style prose for Gu Wen. And actually, what I end up kind of using that quote to say is that it's in response to this issue of colonialism and imperialism that Lin Shu begins to think of a new way to use classical Chinese and to use ancient style prose, and to argue not only that classical Chinese can serve as a kind of medium for translating and transmitting modern knowledge, but also it's a way of critiquing that knowledge and the kind of terms of commensurability that exist between languages.
Right. And the other major text that this chapter looks at is also really interesting, and it's interesting for different kinds of reasons, though. So Lin also works on a translation of Aesop's fables, and interestingly, he works on this with the eldest son and the nephew of Yan Fu, who you mentioned earlier, who is very famous in the history of translation in modern China. Now, this is actually marketed as a textbook, right?
Right. And this is... I have to say, as I was working on this was one of the first books I read when I started the project. I knew that I needed to move in a direction that focused more on print culture, because it's a really beautiful book. When we look at kind of other publications from the first 10 years of the 20th century, I was just struck by the quality of the publication. And it is marketed as a textbook. Okay. And it was also the first translation that Lin Shu prepared for the commercial press, which is an organization in Chinese. It's known as the Shangyin Shuguan, which went on to become it was the largest publisher in China up until the Second World War. And of course, later incarnations, it still remains one of the most important publishers in the Chinese speaking world. And so a number of different things happen here. First of all, we see Lin Shu's labor, his mental labor, his work as a translator being drawn into a publishing world that is very much centered around the production of so-called new style knowledge and textbooks. And the translation itself absolutely works to connect both the stories themselves of Aesop's fables and, of course, by association, the work of the translators to this kind of new style knowledge. So what I argue is that the book is basically a textbook for understanding some of the key terms of Western learning. So there are different stories where I think there's one story where something about a bird builds her nest in a courthouse, but then finds that all of the eggs are eaten up, and then to which Lin Shu appends a commentary talking about international law, or this concept Gong Fa, which was very important in contemporary discourse. There's another case of I believe it's something about... Oh, okay. I was trying to add too many examples in my head at the same time. There's another example of the wolf that eats the lamb.
Right.
And the lamb has somehow become separated from its flock. And when it's separated from its flock, it's eaten up by the wolf. And it's this very kind of... They have this little dialogue between them, and the wolf just keeps coming up for excuses for eating the lamb. And then finally, he just gobbles him up. And Leach's commentary, it all centers around this key term of what's called the grouping, or qun, which can be translated variously as a group, as a kind of term for a proto-nation, as a term for ethnos, has this kind of, it's a very multivalent term. But in this very simple story about animals, we end up having Lin Shu work to link the story to these kind of larger questions of evolution, of race, of questions of likeness and difference between groups of people, so on and so forth. And the book just really works throughout to sort of teach readers how to become, not only how to master this language, but in some ways how to become modern readers themselves.
And what a fantastic text to work on. I mean, if you're going to be doing a close reading of any kind of translation, this just, I mean, you also mention, or you give us examples of images from the text here.
Right.
And so one of the really important things that comes up in the discussion of this for scholars of print culture and book history is that you're underscoring the importance of the material aspects of translation, right? The packaging, the design, the advertising, as a way of sort of showing the ways that publishers really shaped the labor of translators in a way. And but also it's so curiosity stimulating for a reader that this was a moment where I got to the page with the images from different stories of Aesop's Fables in translation. And I immediately wanted to go and sort of make a note to get the whole book and to read through it because it looked like so much fun.
Yeah, it's a really fun text. And just to see the kind of really creative use of print technology that was employed to produce the book, because it seems that they sort of cut and pasted using lithographic technology from a number of different versions of Aesop's Fables. And I spent, you know, this was one of these kinds of wild goose chases where I spent a lot of time looking at miles of microfilm, trying to find the original images. It was to this day, I've never been able to find them. So if anyone out there has a little extra time and wants to try to help me track these down, I would definitely appreciate their help.
Now we move from close readings of these to close readings of texts that we briefly mentioned before, and these are the texts of Charles Dickens. So you focus on two texts here, and I won't ask you to talk about both of them. They were both published in 1908. One is a version of Oliver Twist, rendered as A History of Thieves. Also, because I just love these titles, so I'm going to say all of them.
They are fun. They are fun.
and here's where what's happening is this: the narrator is separated into two narrators, basically, the I and the unofficial historian. And we briefly talked about that before. The other text is a version of The Old Curiosity Shop by Dickens that's called The Biography of Nell, a Filial Girl. Now, very briefly, because this is actually a really important moment where this translation, you argue, poses a conflict between modern ethics and moral behavior. Can you sort of just briefly introduce what's going on in this story and how it's important for the context of translation as a mode of negotiating these two different realms for Lin Shu and his collaborators?
Sure. I think this was probably the most difficult section of the book for me to write, because I think what I ended up really trying to make the argument is that this is a text that in some ways fails in its attempt to negotiate some of these different issues. The translation itself is famous because it uses the word filial. It makes a reference to filial piety. And it's often seen as a kind of real classic example of the way that Lin Shu attempted, and again, this is all sort of in a very caricature view of his work, of an attempt on his part to force works like the novels of Dickens into a very traditionalist mode of understanding human ethics, right? So by using the word filial, I mean, this is sort of almost it's such a loaded term that in itself has often kind of determined the entire interpretation of the work. But what I found when I really read the work closely is that Nell, in some key points in the book, Nell is the kind of very tragic figure who is forced to flee to the countryside with her grandfather and ends up dying at the end. And it's all, you know, lots of tears are shed throughout the novel. And she ends up using this term, Ziyo, freedom or liberty, at several important points in the book. And it really seems to come out of nowhere. And so what I end up arguing is that the book kind of stages this conflict between filial loyalty and this concept of Zio in the figure of Nell. And drawing on some close readings that have been done by other scholars, particularly Theodore Adorno, you know, the work of Adorno, who says that Nell is a kind of sacrificial figure. I argue that this is kind of what happens in the text itself, is that it's in this this particular conflict and that she becomes a kind of sacrificial figure, in which Lin Chu and Wei Yi themselves are not necessarily really, they're able to stage this antinomy or this kind of conflict between the two concepts, but not necessarily able to fully resolve them in any way, just as the novel itself is not really able to produce a satisfying ending. I think that that's something that's important about the Old Curiosity Shop itself and Dickens' work, is that this is one of the most open-ended of his works. And so the translation in its own way reproduces this kind of very troubled, unresolved open-endedness.
Now, as we move into the later chapters of the book, we see a kind of transformation, not just in the nature of the story that you're telling, but also in the nature of Lin Chu himself.
Right.
So I'm sorry, did you want to...
No, go ahead.
Okay. So in the next chapter, and I'm not going to ask you to talk too much about this, just purely for the purpose of time, so that we can kind of get to the later transformations, but you give us a close reading of translations of some of Washington Irving's work in the sketchbook, and the importance of the notion of nostalgia comes up. There's a really wonderful account of a translation of the basic, what listeners or readers will be familiar with as the Rip Van Winkle story, which is really, really fun. And you're also showing here how we're basically seeing a rediscovery of traditionalism in Lin Chu through the process of translation. And he's using translation to formulate a position that's going to be really important in the last couple of chapters of the book and in the last chapters of his life, and ultimately with consequences that maybe aren't so fantastic for him.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And just very briefly, I think what's so interesting about these and why I chose these particular texts is because Washington Irving himself was known as being a traditionalist writer. As one of the most, he was one of the most important, or he was one of the first successful American writers on both sides of the Atlantic. And yet what many English critics saw in his writing was this kind of very precious or stylized imitation or homage of English prose masters from the 18th century. And in the process of translation, Lin Chu was able to figure this out. He's able to sense that there is a certain kind of nostalgia and antiquarianism in Irving's writing. And in that, he kind of discovers a kind of modern traditionalism that he quote unquote discovers, and also kind of creates a version of this modern traditionalism through the writings of Irving and through his kind of visits to many of these. He often combines some of Irving's essays and stories with genres that we see in classical Chinese, particularly the travel log or the youqi. So it becomes a way for Lin Chu also to experiment with using different kinds of classical Chinese genres and combining them in a very free way with the works of Irving.
Now, as we move from this, there's a really nice kind of seamless transition from this to what happens late, very late in Lin Chu's life. Chapter 6 shifts our attention away from what we have focused on before, which is Lin Chu as translator, and it looks at him as what you call a master of ancient style prose, or a guwenjia.
Right.
Now, he becomes a kind of celebrity, and you talk about his success in this chapter, his name, his image, and the kind of cachet, I think as you call it, of tradition that accompanies them, in terms of a commodity that becomes available to reading publics. So can you talk about that aspect of what's happening here, the kind of commodification of all of these different aspects of Lin?
Sure. So throughout, really beginning in 1903, I think it is when he first establishes his relationship with the Shanghui Zhuguan, with the commercial press, this major publishing house. And throughout this period, I mean, he's turning out 10, 15, 20 translations a year with a variety of his collaborators. That's where you get this sort of factory of words that his contemporaries talked about. And it's after he moves to Beijing University, he receives a position at Beijing University, and he's asked by the press to come up with a series of textbooks for what is then at that time called the national language, or Guowen. And we see a really interesting process here at work where Lin Shu, who before he became a translator, was basically unknown, moves through his work as a translator to become an authority on so-called national culture or traditional culture. And so he edits this series of classical Chinese textbooks for the commercial press. And so we see these kinds of attempts, the way that his work is further drawn into the print industry, and by the way that his authority of as a translator also generates authority as a kind of purveyor of traditionalist and classical cultural values. At the same time, we see a kind of further process of commodification, right? So after 1911, he leaves Beijing University after a number of kind of conflicts with other characters who he would later get involved with during the New Culture Movement. And so what we have his first kind of classical Chinese textbooks, and then he opens up a correspondence school, which was something that I was really surprised to find. And it's certainly not very well known chapter of his career, but it's usually been dismissed as a sort of ripoff, right? As many correspondence schools at the time had a very bad reputation of simply taking people's money. But what I found as I looked into the materials is that this is one of the few cases where we really see audience members writing in and providing some idea of how they saw themselves relating to the work of this author. So just for folks who haven't read the book, I look at some of these examples of students who sent in what looked to be writing assignments. And the journal of the correspondence school and just the kind of magazine that came along with the correspondence school would then reprint these essays. And, you know, they go on, and they praise Lin Shu. They praise him for being a kind of star of the literary world, someone who's really upholding traditionalist values in the face of what was really seen across the board as a kind of political and cultural decline in the very messy political times after the 1911 revolution, where this whole sort of cult of personality builds up around him in what I think are new and very interesting ways, and what are very counterintuitive when we look at the cultural history of the 20th century, and we normally don't think of these kinds of things occurring with classical Chinese literature. And so this provides us with a new kind of perspective on how we see the transformation of these practices, especially as we move into the Republican period.
That's right. And it's really interesting because one of the kind of things that's happening here is that you're showing that this image of a traditionalist national identity for Chinese or for China is actually made possible through and is embedded in very modern print technologies.
Right.
And it's also like kind of a part of this story that's very timely right now, because it speaks to a conversation that a lot of us are having about versions of correspondence courses, like massive open online courses and web courses, and the kind of nature of pedagogical technologies and the way that's changing the educated self.
That's absolutely true. And there's one essay that's sent in by a student where he even kind of idealizes this community through correspondence school, where he says, you know, we aren't in the same classroom together. We're separated by rivers and mountains, and uses this kind of flowery language, but then says that it's through this particular new medium. And the correspondence school had really only, as an organized form of education, had only come to China around 1908 or 1909. And so, you know, about 5 or 6 years later, they're working on this correspondence school run by Lin Shu and his collaborators. He sees it a kind of new way of forming a kind of ideal community, that working together can uphold these, what they see as a kind of threatened values of so-called traditional Chinese culture. And of course, it even goes further. As I show in the next chapter, and it's also the cover of the book, we have Lin Shu starts doing endorsements for products. And so we have his endorsement for a Canadian patent medicine called Dr. Williams' Pink Pills for Pale People, which I think I had heard something about this before. But anyway, so he does, you know, there's his photo. And then as well, he writes an endorsement in his own calligraphy. Right. And he was also a sort of noted calligrapher and painter. And so you see writing this essay in his own calligraphy, in classical Chinese, and kind of, I argue, it represents this kind of total commercialization of traditionalist values that becomes, associated with his personality.
So as we come to the last body chapter of the book, I can't let you go without bringing this to a close. And you know, we haven't brought him down yet. We've raised him right up on this pedestal. He's now this media celebrity. So how does he come down off this pedestal? And the way he comes down off this pedestal is the focus of the last body chapter of the book, chapter 7. And this chapter focuses on a famous, or what I learned through reading this, is a famous literary hoax, the case of Mr. Wang Jingxuan. So can you talk for our listeners about this case? Sort of, what did it have to do with translation, and how did it ultimately result in the effective fall from grace of Lin Shu, our hero up to now?
Yes, well, the Wang Jingxuan hoax was orchestrated by at least two people who wrote for the journal New Youth, Xin Qingnian, which we now know of as being, you know, sort of the, in standard histories, is seen as the most important periodical of the New Culture and May 4th movements. And but when they first started, they weren't doing very well. And we find it's possible that the journal itself might have even closed because of lack of interest. And it's right around this time that two figures who are associated with the New Culture movement, Qian Xuantong and Liu Bannong, kind of stage this hoax where they create a character named Wang Jingxuan, who writes this very, very long, stuffy letter to the editor condemning the entire journal and everything they've published, and doing so in very funny ways, and upholding Lin Shu and Yan Fu as the only true sort of leading lights for creating a modern Chinese literature. And the hoax itself is well known, but what I try to do is to argue that there's some very specific parts of the text that actually speak to the environment of the writers at the time. And Wang Jingxuan himself, actually, when he praises Lin Shu, he quotes advertisements from the commercial press. So he's sort of using this kind of advertising slogans in his praise for him. And then in the same issue, there's a long reply. It's actually longer than the original letter from the fictional Mr. Wang Jingxuan that goes and refutes all of his arguments point by point, and then just really savages both Lin Shu and Yan Fu, condemning their work, and particularly singling out Lin Shu for being an excessively commercial writer. It even goes so far as to argue that his writings are fake antiques. And that's, I think, is really very, very important way for for Liu Bannong and Qian Xuantong and these other New Culture writers to position themselves, because the fake antique, it's not only a fake. It's not only a problem because it's a fake, but it's also the consumption of the fake antique is also a problem, because it's quite possible, as we go into, you know, there's lots of fake antiques. If you go to China now, right, you see these in the markets, and people will try to tell you something. Well, this is from the Zhou Dynasty or something like this. But people might buy it knowing full well that it's a fake antique and still enjoy it. And really, the image of the fake antique is a critique of this entire circuit of production and consumption between Lin Shu, his publishers, and his collaborators. And after that, then, Lin Shu is gradually drawn into a conflict in print with the New Culture and May 4th writers. And there's lots of details that I won't go into here. But really, he ends up making the argument in terms on terms where he just can't win, and eventually really comes to be associated with the warlord government, and all kinds of accusations fly back and forth whether or not he's trying to lead a purge at Beijing University and so forth. But he's really just sort of shamed into withdrawing from the literary scene, and that ultimately cements his reputation as an arch conservative, particularly because he ends up being on the wrong side of this debate between New Culture and May 4th intellectuals who we now think of as being really the touchstone and the center of Chinese literary and cultural modernity.
Well, thank you so much. So just to mention for listeners that there's also a conclusion that not only opens with an epigram, or an epigraph rather, which is a short passage written by Lin Xu from his deathbed on his son's palm, which just blew my mind. I mean, just the image of this, you know, this hero, and he's fallen from grace, and the final epigraph is something he wrote from his deathbed on his son's palm. Blows my mind. That image is going to stay with me for a long time. And in this conclusion, you look at the ways that these problems faced by Lin Xu and his collaborators actually reemerge at other key moments in modern Chinese political and literary history, and sort of the problems of the written style of translations and of the sort of different levels of translators' knowledge of foreign languages. So this story about the sort of the changing ways that translation and its modes and understandings of what that should and can look like, the ways that that's imbricated in the history of modernity and of sort of changing notions of the nation and the self, and in the context of global history, actually continues through the conclusion and perhaps beyond. So thank you so much. There's so much in the book, obviously, that we didn't have a chance to talk about, Michael. Is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Off the top of my head, I think I would just say what I found, first of all, is that it was a very fun book to write. And I think, again, for folks who are working on their first project, I think it was an important piece of advice that I got was to simply like your topic and to sort of enjoy the material that you're working on. And I found it to be extremely, for the most part, a very fun project to work on. Of course, the process of writing any book is can really be a struggle at times. I think that what I'm interested in kind of continuing with in some ways is reading other translated or sort of other kinds of texts that continue to be at the margins of intellectual, literary, and cultural history from this period. And so I hope that certainly the kind of close readings of the translations were, I'd be interested to see what readers have to say about that and what kind of feedback they have for me.
So now that this book is out, and congratulations on not only a great but a really beautiful book, what's next for you? What project is currently inspiring you at the moment?
I have a couple of things I'm working on right now. Having worked as a translator in the past, I found myself being drafted into it again on occasion. And right now I'm working on a translation of the introduction to The Rise of Modern Chinese Thought, by Wang Hui, which is going to be published as a separate short book by Harvard University Press. And hopefully I'm working on the I'm have a draft of the translation completed, and hopefully we'll be able to send it off to the publisher and reviewers and all of that by the middle of this year. I've also just kind of worked on some other things that were interesting me as I worked on the project itself. So I recently just did an article on English language correspondence schools in Republican China and their connection to the evolution of an idea of a national language, of a guoyu, in 1920s, in the 1910s and 1920s. And I'm continuing to do work along those lines.
Great. Well, thank you again so much for making the time. It really was a pleasure, and best of luck with your next projects.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.